Welcome to Foresight Friday Roundup, Foresight Health's podcast series for healthcare revolutionaries. Outcomes matter, customers count, and value rules. Hello again, everyone. This is Dave Burda, news editor at Foresight Health. It is Friday, May 6th. This is the start of National Nurses Week, which runs through Thursday. If you know a nurse, make sure you say thank you. They really do need some love right now. On today's episode of the Roundup, we're going to talk about the industry implications of the leaked Supreme Court ruling that would strike down Roe versus Wade and eliminate abortion as a constitutionally protected right. Talking about anything else on today's show, I think, would be trivial, given the gravity of the draft opinion if it becomes law. To tell us how the ruling could affect the traditional and non-traditional sectors of the healthcare market are Dave Johnson, founder and CEO of Foresight Health, and Julie Murchison, partner at Transformation Capital. Hi, Dave. Hi, Julie. How are you guys doing this morning? Dave?
It's overcast, rainy, and dreary here in Chicago. I'm feeling the same way. Very sad for our country at this moment of intense political division.
I hear you. Julie, how are you?
Well, I got a wicked sunburn. So my PSA for everybody is throw out all the sunscreen you owned before COVID.
Good health tip for today. Thank you. Now, before we talk about the implications of the ruling for healthcare, let me ask you about where you were when you heard the news and what your initial reaction was. Dave, when did you first hear about the leaked opinion?
I first heard that news on Tuesday morning listening to NPR. Although I wasn't necessarily surprised, my first reaction was the thought, wow, they're really going to do this, fully overturn Roe v. Wade and all the precedents before and since that 1973 ruling. It was a chilling moment as I contemplated the far-reaching potential impacts of that ruling should it come to be.
Interesting, yeah. Julie, when did you hear the news? How did it break for you?
Well, I was actually at a healthcare meeting listening to a Republican representative speak about international affairs, and someone in the audience asked him a question about the domestic events of the day. And I had been heads down in this meeting, not really paying attention to what had been happening. And that's how I found out. It was quite interesting because he didn't want to talk about the domestic events of the day. He wanted to talk about the international situation. So, yeah.
Staying on message, right? Unbelievable. For me, I came downstairs early on Tuesday and my wife was watching TV and crying. She's a nurse and she teaches obstetrical nursing at our local university. And she told me the news and explained the negative impact on maternal health. Very upsetting for both of us, but especially for her, of course. You know me, I was just about to make a crack about what sad movie she was watching, and that would have been very unfortunate. So
perhaps marriage ending, actually.
Yeah, dodged a bullet there. Absolutely. Dave, I'm going to ask you to speculate on how the court's opinion, if it becomes law, could affect some of the traditional sectors of the healthcare industry, like hospitals, doctors, insurers, and employers. Tell me two or three things that we might expect to see and why.
That's a touching story, Dave, about you and your wife, and I applaud your discretion there. Thanks for sharing it with our audience.
Sure.
I'm going to go off script before giving specific examples of how the potential ruling could affect traditional industry players. Robert Putnam may be the nation's leading social scientist. He's the author of Bowling Alone, which many have heard of, that revealed more Americans are bowling than ever, but there are many fewer bowling leagues, which was a keen way of observing the decline in social connection within broader American society. So I've been thinking a lot about his latest book in the wake of this ruling or potential ruling, Upswing, which examines economic equality, political consensus, cultural cohesion, and individual connection with society for the 120-year period beginning in 1900 at the time of the Gilded Age through the current day. All four curves, economics, politics, culture, and society, have the same shape. They start very low and then improve consistently until the mid to late 1960s, when they peak and decline consistently to the point where today America has the same levels of economic inequality, political divisiveness, cultural separation and lack of societal connection as it did during the Gilded Age. Pretty remarkable. Putnam terms this the I pattern, as the nation moved from intensely individualistic to a we're all in it together mindset, and then back to intensely individualistic. There were four fault lines that triggered the reversal in the 1960s: economic inequality, race, feminism, and the environment. Those fault lines are still with us. The abortion debate touches on three of them, which is why it's so divisive. Berta, you and I are old enough to remember what it was like to live in a country where everyone was pulling in the same direction. It wasn't perfect, but there was broad confidence in America's future and our ability to solve big problems. It's not a coincidence that Medicare and Medicaid emerged during this period of national unity in the early 60s. The real question underlying the Roe ruling for me is whether the U.S. can regain that level of unity as a country with a multi-ethnic, multicultural, and more tolerant population. You know, we'll see. But I think that's the big question. Regarding a ruling's potential impact on incumbents, I'll make three quick observations. It's probably toughest on providers operating across state lines as they adapt to state-specific laws and regulations, as well as when mandates conflict. For example, the EMTALA right to emergency care and state bans against abortion. Secondly, this ruling will also highlight the divide between Catholic and other religiously sponsored healthcare providers that limit family planning services with sectarian sponsored healthcare providers that don't. That fault line will likely deepen as health systems consolidate and expand across state lines. Finally, insurance companies, employers that offer healthcare services won't be able to dodge the question anymore whether or not they actively assist women desiring abortions. We saw Amazon this week, for example, declare that it would fund travel costs for its employees who need to travel to other states to receive abortion services. And then one last comment on the federal state jurisdiction debate that's at the center of the Roe ruling. The Articles of Confederation didn't work the first time, and they won't work now.
Got it, Dave. Great analysis. Thank you. Julie, any comments or questions for Dave?
Well, Dave, we're seeing some blowback on the medical community for things they could have done historically to prevent this from happening. What do you think about some of that commentary? And do you think there's anything they can do now, given the political situation?
Oh, I think the commentary is accurate. The only time medicine really unites is when it's asking a society to fork over ever more money for healthcare services. On tough questions like this one, they duck and run and hide for cover for the most part. There have been a few organizations, including the AMA, that have come out with statements expressing real concern about a potential ruling. I don't think those will make any difference at all, but they should still make them. You know, the real question for me in the medical community is when will they really care about putting consumer and patients' interests first ahead of their own economic interests? And until that happens, or until the marketplace forces that to happen, I just don't put a whole lot of stock in their political positioning, including on this very important issue.
Yeah, I think the fact that it took the AMA 3 days to say something speaks volumes. Now let's talk about the non-traditional sectors of the industry. I'm thinking digital health startups, new care delivery models, new market entrants, new payer models, that sort of thing. Julie, you have a great view of this sector of the industry. If the ruling becomes law, what two or three things could we see and why?
I think maybe the most important thing going on right now is that it was only in December that the FDA made a permanent rule change allowing patients to receive abortion pills by mail without having to visit, you know, some sort of specialist or certified provider. So that's a big deal given where we are right now. And the first startup I think that is really taking this on in an aggressive way is a company called Hey Jane. And it's basically a digital abortion clinic that connects patients to licensed providers and delivers abortion pills to front doors. And Kiki Friedman, who's their co-founder, said that, you know, this move now makes mail order abortion care, which I think is a phrase we're going to start hearing a lot, now likely to be the most viable form of access for most people in the country. So she thinks the biggest hurdle, frankly, and I can't disagree, is that we have a huge lack of education among consumers that medication-induced abortions are possible. And the issue is they apparently represent the majority of abortions performed today, but only 1 in 5 people knows it's an option. So just think about that. It's not, you know, very well understood. So, you know, when you look at companies like this, she anticipates they're going to be able to continue operating in New York, California, Washington, Illinois, Colorado, and New Mexico, which accounts for just over 50% of national abortions. So that's a lot of states, and they're certainly preparing, like many other companies are. Maven's another one. It was started by women who went through a really difficult miscarriage process. So these are women who have relied on these services for part of their lives for very critical medical reasons. And they've developed a Maven Wallet, which is an app that helps consumers calculate the cost of reproductive procedures and facilitates reimbursement. So it helps American companies like Amazon cover expenses for women seeking out-of-state care. And they, like so many other companies, including Clio and others, are providing options for counseling and a forum for people to learn about their choices. So those are, I think, some big examples. Some of the direct-to-consumer pharma and telehealth companies we've discussed on this show now sit in a really pivotal position around being able to grow more of a business around this, certainly in the mail order area and in the patient education and provider connection area. And, you know, novel models like Tia have come out talking about their support as well and what they've been doing waiting for this post-Roe era to happen. So I think these digital health companies have been pretty prepared. I also noticed when you look at some of the press on health plans, some of the larger health plans have been slammed for not reimbursing a lot of services in this area. So some of the new startup health plans and PBMs may have an opportunity to really set themselves apart, especially those who are targeting younger demographics like Friday health plans. And last, I'll just say a shout out to Lux Capital's Dina Shakir, who has invested in several digital health startups that focus on women's health and equity. And she said that reproductive rights are human rights, and women's health is population health. They are inextricable. So I applaud her for her insights, her perspective, and for sharing.
Yeah, that is very interesting. Suddenly, the postmaster general position becomes even more important, right?
Yeah.
If a lot of this stuff is flowing through the Postal Service. Dave, any comments or questions for Julie?
My favorite quote of the week was that men are responsible for triggering 100% of unwanted pregnancies. So there you go. Dave, your comment about the Postmaster General kind of gets to the question I wanted to ask Julie. Many of the new business models you describe use technologies and services that cross state lines. Any thoughts or concerns regarding how the breakdown of federal and state jurisdiction embedded within a Roe reversal could inhibit innovation and or the spread of value-based care within the broader U.S. marketplace?
Yeah, I don't know if you caught the Atlantic article, Berta, good highlight there. But what's scary about what Alito's doing in this work is it's creating precedent to break down a lot of federalism and give power to the states. So there could be all sorts of things that unravel from this that have nothing to do with abortion services and have everything to do with business models that need to get back to a place that makes certain people in this country probably a lot of money. So I worry a lot about that. Companies in digital health have spent millions of dollars, especially in the early days, trying to hire law firms to do big legal analyses to figure out the 50-state plan and how they're going to work their business model around and through that. So there's been a lot invested in making these models work across state lines. I do think we are going to see, just like Hey Jane said, there are certain states they'll be able to operate in and certain states they won't. I suspect we're going to see some creative models for the next couple of years until some court decisions get figured out around how those models can function, with licensure, you know, being much more flexible in the last couple of years. But we might be going back to a very choppy healthcare delivery environment state by state, if abortion starts to unravel that. I worry a lot about that.
Got it. Yeah, no, that's great, Julie. Thank you. You know, I think letting state legislatures decide our reproductive rights is lunacy. You're born with those rights and no one should be able to take those away from you, especially a group of people who I wouldn't trust to order a pizza because they're so uninformed and incompetent. All right. No doubt we'll be revisiting this topic in a month or two. Now let's briefly talk about other news that happened this week. Julie, was there anything else that caught your attention this week that's worth noting?
Well, this is not exactly new news, but more happening on the front with Calibrate. They're being investigated for their prescribing habits for Adderall and other drugs on their platform and using practices that are not appropriate. So I do think, Dave, to your question about 50-state line and licensure issues, we're seeing digital health companies that are really pushing the boundaries of what's medically appropriate and getting some pushback on it. So we're going through an interesting period now with mail order anything.
Got it. Thanks, Julie. Dave, what other healthcare news blipped on your radar this week?
Hello, FDA. I'm Julie. Biogen finally threw in the towel this week on its controversial drug, Aduhelm. It announced that its CEO, Mikael Vounatsos, will leave the company and that it will eliminate its sales infrastructure for the drug. Lest we forget, Biogen was willing to bankrupt the Medicare Trust Fund to receive government payment for its expensive and crappy Alzheimer's drug. It might have succeeded if Aduhelm had been more effective. We dodged a bullet here, but the threat of pharmaceutical overreach on mass market drugs is still alive and very, very real.
I think they'd call it a market correction, right?
Yes.
Good for the market. Thanks, Dave, and thank you, Julie. That is all the time we have for today. If you'd like to learn more about the topics we discussed on today's show, please visit our website at foresighthealth.com. If you follow our show on Apple Podcasts or your favorite streaming service, you'll get notified each time a new episode is available. Don't forget to tell a friend about Foresight Friday Roundup. Subscribe now and don't miss another segment of the best 20 minutes in healthcare. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Berta for Foresight Health.